I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound Archive writing.upenn.edu/PennSound. Today I'm joined here in Philadelphia in the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by Katie Price, associate editor of the Electronic Poetry Center, EPC, an assistant editor at Jacket 2, where you specialize in doing interviews, among other things, who has a poetry manuscript titled BRCA. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Is it an acronym for something?
Yes.
Tell us.
Breast cancer.
Okay, breast cancer, which was a finalist in a contest but is still unpublished as of this moment. Is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, that
okay,
is correct.
So anybody who wants to publish it, let us know.
Yeah, let me know.
Currently organizing a conference on poetry communities, is writing a book-length study of pataphysical practice, and who grew up in Utah, not far from Spiral Jetty.
That's right.
And by Julia Block, who traveled from L.A. to join us today, veteran of Bay Area independent and progressive publishing at Tacoon Curve and other venues, fabulously talented editor, a widely published poet, author of Post-Psychiatric Sonnets, and a series of letters to Kelly Clarkson, which I think is now being published by whom?
Sidebrow Books in San Francisco.
Fantastic. And who, along with Michael Hennessy, is editor of Jacket 2. And I'm happy to say, by Anne Waldman, an active member, to say the least, of the experimental poetry community as a writer, performer, collaborator, teacher, mentor, editor, anthologist, radical mentor, pedagogue. Sorry, I added that one. Scholar. I'm not sorry. Scholar and cultural political activist, co-founder of Naropa, and great advocate of alternative forms of learning, author of more than 40 books and small press editions of poetry and poetics, who's raised on McDougal Street in the Village, got her BA at Bennington, I'm just randomly picking some things, and served in a crucial period as director of the Poetry Project of St. Mark's, and just to add one more thing, appeared with Bob Dylan, among others, in the amazing film Rinaldo and Clara.
Oh my goodness, well, you've done your homework.
Well, I don't know about that. Welcome back to the third floor, Julia and Katie.
Thanks, Al. Thanks.
And Anne, thank you so much for being here. And
thank
for the
you.
Great talk that you gave here at the Writer's House just a few hours ago. We're all still really jazzed about that.
Thank you.
Well, today we've gathered to talk about a poem by Bernadette Mayer. It is called The Tragic Condition of the Statue of Liberty, subtitled A Collaboration with Emma Lazarus. And I think most of us encountered this poem first in Andrei Codrescu's 1987 anthology, Up Late, American Poetry Since 1970. That was 1987. Our recording of the poem comes from an ear-in reading dated October 15th, 1988. So here now is Bernadette Mayer performing The Tragic Condition of the Statue of Liberty.
The Tragic Condition of the Statue of Liberty. A collaboration with Emma Lazarus. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, the tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Give me your gentrificatees of the Lower East Side, including all the well-heeled young Europeans who will take apartments without leases. Give me your landlords. Give me your cooperators. Give me the guys who sell the food and the computers to the public schools in District 1. Give me the IRS, FBI, CIA men who don't take Election Day off. Give me certain members of the school board and give me the district superintendent. Give me all the greedy members of both American and foreign capitalist religious sects. Give me the parents of the punk people. Give me the guy who puts those stickers in the Rice Krispies. Give me the doctor who thinks his time is more valuable than mine and my daughter's and the time of all the other non-doctors in this world. Give me the mayor, his mansion, and the president and his White House. Give me the cops who laugh and sneer at meetings where they demonstrate the new uses of mace and robots instead of the old murder against people who are being evicted. Give me the landlord's sleazy lawyers and the deal-making judges in housing court, and give me the landlord's arsonist. Give me the known and unknown big important rich guys who now bank on our quaint neighborhood. Give me, forgive me, the writers who have already or want to write bestsellers in this country. Together we will go to restore Ellis Island, ravaged for years by wind, weather, and vandals. I was surprised and saddened when I heard that the Statue of Liberty was in such a serious state of disrepair, and I want to help. This is the most generous contribution that I can afford.
Well, Anne, I want to turn to you in a second to hear, you know, one of many ideas that you have about this poem, and we can respond to it. Before I do that, I want to ask Katie and Julia about the phrase, give me. It's important. It comes from the Statue of Liberty, Lazarus, but it starts to morph. Any thoughts on the way that phrase works in this poem, Katie?
Well, I like near the end where she writes, give me, forgive me. And I think that's a crucial moment in the poem where it switches to this relationship of exchange to a relationship of collaboration and cooperation and solidarity. So I think that's an important switch that really gets to the heart of the irony of the poem.
What is it in Lazarus, in the original? How does it read, give me?
In the original, it appears, I think, in quotation marks. I mean, it's really a quotation that we get in the poem. The poem is imagining what the Statue of Liberty is actually saying. And so I feel like Bernadette is, she's speaking for the statue, but as Katie says, she also kind of morphs. And this is a really modern mother of exiles. This is not, you know, the Colossus.
Bernadette is, rather
yes,
than the
yes,
Statue
absolutely.
Of Liberty.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a generous plea. Give me, I'll take all this. But it also turns into an angry imperative.
Right.
Give me this and give me that. I'll do what I need to do with it. Yeah. Does it mock greediness? Give me. It's almost like it's a
poem.
Yeah, I
would
that,
say
hey,
so. I think it plays with that, definitely. But it also has this other, you know, the original sense of the Lazarus poem and, you know, speaking for the statue, as you were saying, and then it, you know, and then morphing and playing with the irony. And I actually wrote to Bernadette to find out something of the provenance, and she was saying she was having a hard time with the school board or whatever the school district was, trying to get whole wheat bread into the cafeteria, dealing with the landlord who had hired an arsonist, evidently, to set a fire in the building. And she said she had a lawyer that reminded her of Abe Lincoln. So again, the sort of combination of the, you know, the ironies of the historical and, you know, the plea for the repair of liberty, et cetera, in these very daily exigencies of, you know, trying to get her kids through school. And I love
Fantastic.
The little Rice Krispie thing, you know, this great
the
little
stickers.
Luminous detail.
Yeah,
and what did it say? You know, was it trying to sell you something? Or I was trying to remember my own experiences with
I think
cereal
it was a prize.
Coupons. Sometimes a prize, yeah.
Well, that's
but
what's
it's a
so
great little
great
surprise
about
it's
Bernadette like, here. I always get the feeling that her sense of radical democracy is extremely local, extremely issue-oriented.
Yeah.
But it's also archival. It's, you know, she's always quoting Hawthorne and she's quoting, you know, historical figures from earlier in the life of American democracy. Mm-hmm. And so it's extremely contemporary, but also always with this, I think, historical view.
And doesn't it end with a certain amount of true allegiance? This is obviously pro-democracy poem.
But to poetry.
But to
the
poetry.
The efficacy
right.
of poetry.
Yeah.
You know, that I can, this is what I can give you.
Yeah.
And so the exchange is on this different level and something that's so marginalized in the civic culture in this, you know, in our world of all these, and the list, the endless lists of all these government officials and, you know, from the White House to the, and then you know, thinking of the Lazarus poem, there's still, I mean, it was so relevant. There's still the homeless at the gates. And I was reading, I thought, I'm going to read it in public space. And I was reading it on the subway. And of course, the subway broke down. We had to get off. It's the IND
line.
The
Lazarus or this?
This poem,
yeah.
Bernadette's poem. And I was trying to do a civic kind of ritual thing with it, and they were homeless outside the terminal trying to get in, and they're, you know, rats on the, you know, just the incredible disrepair of our state of the of being on this, in our culture, in our country.
And here the disrepair is specifically, we all realize this, those of us who lived in the East, specifically at this time, it was the disrepair of this monument, of the Statue of Liberty.
Right.
So in a way she's contributing this poem as the best, the only donation she knows how to give to the repair of this symbol of democracy. So it becomes, it's really kind of a poem that I think, cuts across ideologies. It's really very disarming.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that it was closed for a couple of years. It was closed again, I remember, after 9/11, but it was closed between 84, I think, and 86, and they were repairing the torch, which, of course, is the beacon. And that's another irony. And then to repair that with the offering of the poem, I think it's the best thing you could do.
It's fantastic. I'm so glad that we picked this poem because it's perfect. How, Julia, you read a lot, Bernadette. What do you think is characteristic of her poetry in general that we see here?
Well, I think the motherhood is incredibly characteristic, and we mentioned that earlier. But I'm coming back to this idea that for Emma Lazarus, she saw the Statue of Liberty as the mother of exiles, and I think Bernadette is really insisting on motherhood as a form of activism. It's not a form of just repair or care or mending the fabric of society. It's getting shit done. It's intervening, mm-hmm. and trying to, as you said, get the whole wheat bread into the schools and fight for renters' rights and stuff like that. And she's also insisting on motherhood as a valid topic for poetry.
Mm-hmm. Katie, what do you see here in this poem that's typical of Mayer's approach generally?
Yeah, I think the irony and the sincerity. I think Bernadette really couples those two things really well, right? You get at the end a really sincere, this is my offering, right? I think you could read that as, this is the only thing I can afford, could be read as sort of flippant, but here it's really sincere, and I think that's a characteristic of her poetry.
Give me the known and unknown big important rich guys who now bank on our quaint neighborhood. Give me, forgive me, the writers who have already or want to write bestsellers in this country. Together we will go to restore Ellis Island, ravaged for years by wind, weather, and vandals. I was surprised and saddened when I heard that the Statue of Liberty was in such a serious state of disrepair, and I want to help. This is the most generous contribution that I can afford.
I'm looking at the original by Emma Lazarus, and it reads, from her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome, her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor. There's nothing mild about Bernadette's poem, and
right.
I love that. And I also think about the title, The Tragic Condition of the Statue of Liberty, and I think, there's a lot of tragedy that's being confronted in Bernadette's poem, and in a way, there were a lot of tragic conditions surrounding the Statue of Liberty throughout history, mm-hmm. and the fact that she came to function as a symbol of trying to repair relationships between different nations. And she was really put at this, I'm calling her she, which is interesting, but the statue was really at the center of a lot of debates around immigration, which are mm-hmm. It's so timely, to be talking about this at this moment when immigration is again such a hot topic in the culture wars.
And she says, let's all go to Ellis Island and repair.
End, it's not really about it is true that around the time that she wrote this poem, you couldn't go up to the top but really it's Ellis Island that's in disrepair at the end of this mm-hmm. poem, which is to say completely unenlightened immigration policy. And by the way, not just in the Reagan era, this is a mm-hmm. Reagan era poem, mm-hmm. for people coming from Central America, really limiting, even if they're running for their lives, but also in the 1940s when we were all praising immigration. We were just not letting people in. We just don't have a... So that the tragedy is, she says, sad.
And that's when that's when Emma Lazarus's poem became really popularized, mm-hmm. also was in the 30s and
40s.
At the time, in the 40s, people like Woody Guthrie, who were, who's really sort of affiliated with the communist movement, to be sure, maybe even a member of the party.
Absolutely.
But his way would be to turn a happy face on that at a time mm-hmm. of a united front. Mm-hmm. Turn a happy face on that and just say, this land is your land, it's my land, the Statue of Liberty, we're great, and everything's going to be okay. This was a way of being happy about it. That's not what Bernadette is doing by the 1980s. Mm-hmm. The agitprop mm-hmm. is pretty seriously dissident.
Mm-hmm.
Such a difference. This is I'm really going to ask a stupid question.
I did want to say, though, that the title Bernadette wrote, that was actually the headline in the New York Times.
That's what I thought, too. It was the headline.
So that's interesting to me in light of something like Lana Turner has collapsed.
Exactly.
Which is a headline. So that's another level.
But it's not being ironized, though, right? She really does think it's tragic.
Yes. No, it's a little different. But the fact that, using the headline in that way,
right.
And respond, and also the instant quality of the headline, the daily news, right. And
it's
so
like
on.
The poem is a fact.
Fact.
So you want to know about the tragic condition of the staff? I'll tell you about the tragedies, because it's
exactly.
Associated with all this activism that's so hard to do. Here was the stupid question I wanted to ask a second ago. I was contrasting the happy agitprop United Front style of someone like Woody Guthrie, whom, by the way, I revere, so I'm not saying anything bad. And this is a different style. I think I know I prefer this. Why is this such a good strategy, politically speaking? I mean, one could get something done with a poem like this.
Well, she's looking into the darkness of her own time and using, you know, the disrepair, the dysfunction, the dystopia, waking you up to that and also to these other levels. But I think the difference would be the mothering quality of her ethos, let's say.
And in a way, the identification with a version of the Statue of Liberty, which Woody Guthrie couldn't really do.
And the original poem written by a woman who was, I guess, a Jewish background, but Sephardic Jewish background, interesting, mongrel coming. And then were all these kind of mongrels, you know, mongrel mothers. And
one of the things I also like about this poem is that it complicates the Statue of Liberty as only a symbol for immigration, right? So lots of the poem is about gentrification. So it's
Can
not...
Can you point out a spot? Great. I mean, there are some obvious ones.
Yeah. The very first line that goes away from quoting the poem is, "Give me your gentrificatees of the Lower East Side, including all the well-heeled young Europeans," right? So that's where she starts. So she's complicating this as a symbol of immigration and saying, isn't it ironic that the Statue of Liberty people are asking for donations to repair the Statue of Liberty, right? To these very same people who are ruining communities in New York and kicking people who have lived there for a really long time out of their homes.
Can we do a little footnote historically?
Sure.
We've got to talk something about the mid to late 80s when Reaganism really started to affect the Lower East Side in particular. I mean, can we say a little bit for listeners of this program who might not know what, you know, historically specific things she's referring to?
Well, so I was forced out of my apartment, and
just to be
suddenly
specific
and
about
the,
it, yeah.
Yes, the rent had been originally something like $125, and it was going up in little increments. But then the owner really wanted to. It was on St. Mark's Place. Wanted to sell the building, and eventually did, and turned these. Well, anyway, that's a long story.
No,
so I felt I had to go to court. I had to fight.
Right.
I had to so on and so forth. And in terms of the far, you know, I just read a piece in the paper about how the foreigners like to come, and they come into these areas, but they like the public schools. They really like the public schools in America because their children get more acclimatized and there's more diversity. And I thought that was interesting, another little layer of how it benefits these others. I mean, Bernadette is always taking issue with wealth. It's pretty interesting.
She says, "Give me the known and unknown, big, important, rich guys." I'm interested in the unknown.
Yes, who are they?
Yeah. I mean, in other words, if you're working in a community, and people might be bastards, but typically in a, I don't want to say pre-modern, but pre-80s community, urban community, you're probably going to know a lot of the people around. Once it becomes unknown, there's these people who are investing elsewhere. They're flipping buildings and so forth. Mm. In a poem like this, because it's so listy, because it's so New York-y, winds up disclosing, we don't know their names, but disclosing the fact of their unknownness.
And then there are these writers, you know, the writers who with their careerism and different agenda.
Ah, the reference to the bestsellers.
Yeah. So the, you know, suddenly there's this divisive thing in the community, in the heart community in a way, which is, it still goes on, our Lower East Side community. Luckily, some people have been able to hold on to their little corners.
So when she says bestsellers, there's a bit of laughter, like solidarity laughter in the audience.
In the reading, yeah.
In the reading. But it's she bashes them in a way, but it's also a little tender. It's like,
can't quite blame them.
No, I mean, I don't know about that, but help me here. She's not really disgusted by them.
Well, any writer can, you know, has a certain...
Any writer is okay, yeah. Julia,
and the next line is, "Together we will go to restore Ellis Island." And I feel like, to go back to our earlier discussion about the repetition of "give me," there's definitely a critique here of these known and unknown rich people. But I almost feel like the poem's saying we're all in the same boat. Like, the great myth of New York City is that it's the great equalizer. Everyone can make it no matter what the class divisions. I don't think she's making that kind of claim, but I think she is suggesting there is something that binds all of these disparate classes, even though I'm making room in this poem for a lot of anger, a lot of, you know, really, really serious critique of the material conditions of what's mm-hmm. breaking down mm-hmm. around me right now.
Can we say something really obvious about the power of a list poem, or a power of a poem that used repetitive structures in its relation to democracy? I mean, I know sort of an obvious thing, but we should say it. Katie, you're on.
I mean, I think one of the best things that a list poem can do, right, is bring together things that are very different in a very visceral way. Right, so just like Julia was saying, that even though this poem has a lot of anger, it also connects all of these things, right? Bernadette is connected to these wealthy unknown people in New York. And so I think the list poem has a real power to bring together these two very disparate things.
All items on the list are created equal.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? I mean, there's Whitmanism here, mm-hmm. you know, there's O'Haraism yeah. and Berriganism, mm-hmm. whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And this is a radical statement at the level of form. And Emma Lazarus gave it to us with the Give Me.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it's really like finding a lineage here about its formal democracy. That's
yeah.
why the
yeah.
bestsellers are part of the team, because like Whitman, I mean, he's embracing all kinds of creepy people.
Maybe the best-selling writers are the storied pomp that Emma Lazarus says. You know, Emma says, keep them. You give us just the poor people mm-hmm. And the masses. And Bernadette's saying, actually, I'll take everybody. mm-hmm. You know.
So Anne mentioned the Occupy movement, and we, you know, we, I think Anne and I over email seized upon this poem partly because of its reference to the creative new uses of mace and the way
robot.
In which the
robot. Drones.
Oh, you were very interested in drones and robots. I mean, so do we, I think this is an incredibly relevant poem. Can we just say why we think so? I mean, Anne, starting with you?
Yeah, absolutely, because these things continue. I mean, the gentrification of Queens, the gentrification of the far reaches of Brooklyn, the economic disparity, which just gets worse and worse, the civic, you know, the lack of trust in the civic guardians, supposedly, and then the, you know, the poet that's can still, thank God, you know, you feel she's saddened and wiser and can make this offering with a, you know, some kind of humor, but it just goes on and on. And then to point up all the cultural, you know, ironies and historical ironies, and not to forget the archive, you know, is so important. So I see this as part of this, you know, archive in my own view and in my own work. So it's quite relevant.
Kate, you were going to say something a minute ago.
Yeah, I was. Just going back to the Occupy movement a little bit. I love this line. It's near the end. It's the known and unknown coming up again. Give me the known and unknown big, important, rich guys who now bank on our quaint neighborhood. And I think the language in this poem is fairly simple, but that's a moment where one of those words mm-hmm. is complicated, right? Mm-hmm. Right, bankers banking on a neighborhood, creating a bank, all those sort of things sort of come right there with bank and quaint neighborhood. And I just think that's a beautiful moment. And I think that line really speaks to Occupy in a literal way.
It's really witty.
Yeah.
Give me certain members of the school board and give me the district superintendent. Give me all the greedy members of both American and foreign capitalist religious sects. Give me the parents of the punk people. Give me the guy who puts those stickers in the Rice Krispies. Give me the doctor who thinks his time is more valuable than mine and my daughter's and the time of all the other non-doctors in this world. Give me the mayor, his mansion, and the president and his White House. Give me the cops who laugh and sneer at meetings where they demonstrate the new uses of mace and robots instead of the old murder against people who are being evicted. Give me the landlord's sleazy lawyers and the deal-making judges in housing court, and give me the landlord's arsonist.
For our students, 21, 22 years old, we need to talk about what happened when Reaganomics really started to kick in by the mid to late 80s. And this is really what she's reacting to at the level of the urban centers.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as Anne is just suggesting, I'm repeating it, but it has this incredible relevance today. So it does the two things you want a poem to do. All right, so what I'd like to go around and ask each of you just to add one more thought that you were worried we wouldn't get to and in fact didn't. Katie, a last thought on this?
Oh, I don't know. The bank thing was sort of my last thought that I wanted to get in. But I also wanted to point to her reference to her daughter, which I think it's back to what Julia said at the very beginning about the mothering. And I think that's just such a beautiful moment, right, where she's talking about the doctor who thinks their time is more valuable than mine and my daughter's. And that sort of situates the poem. I know we had talked about how it's historical and it's influencing these people who are rent payers in New York, right? But it's also influencing the next generation and our children and this impact that it has on them.
Terrific. Thank you, Julia.
I was thinking a lot about the word colossus, which is the new colossus is the title of Emma Lazarus's poem. And I looked it up in my dictionary, and according to whatever dictionary it was I had, it said a statue which is larger than life. And I thought, what a strange definition. What is a life-size statue? What, you know, for a statue? And I love this poem because we are hearing the colossus speak, and the identity of that speaker shifts so much, which is also super characteristic of Bernadette's poetry, which is collaging in so much heard speech, overheard speech, and she's shifting speaker positions and subjectivities. So I like the idea that this is the new colossus for Bernadette's moment and maybe our own.
It's also a gendered colossus.
Yes, it's very gendered.
So, you know, if you take Sylvia Plath's not gendered colossus, it's her dad.
That's right.
Specifically. And if you take Artie Spiegelman's colossus, also a downtown guy, it's his dad.
That's right.
And these people are casting horrible psycho-emotional shadows. That's not what Bernadette's relationship to this colossus is. It's a positive one, yeah. And your last thought on
Well,
this?
I wanted to bring in a note. This is from Bernadette, where she talks of having, you know, the pipes are broken and having to carry buckets of water to the 12th floor to help neighbors about trying to organize a rent strike. And so, you know, I feel like there's something in that's paralleling her activism in the moment too. So in a way, it's a kind of prescription. I was thinking of Diane de Prima's Revolutionary Letters, or, you know, where you're right there, and there are these steps, you know, that you're taking. Do this. Take the water upstairs. Note that the landlord is a. She says in this note too that she liked to call them cutthroats. Which I thought was, you know, it's strong language. So just to bring in the fact that, and then also researching Emma Lazarus a little bit, she was actually a real activist and created homes for Jewish immigrants who were having a hard time. They could get, it was a school, I think, a Hebrew technical school, and so they could get training as they came in as immigrants. So again, this sense of what doing something, that this is just activated, not just some frustrated Lower East Side poet, as we've all been
there. Bernadette is creating a direct lineage from someone who is essentially a proletarian poet.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's, definitely. Talk about agitprop and Woody Guthrie. I mean, you know, there is a frank embrace of proletarianism through a different formal mode.
And someone who heard about the Statue of Liberty and decided to write a poem. I mean, she certainly wasn't commissioned to write a poem that would later appear on a plaque. The plaque didn't even appear until after her death. You know, this was Lazarus's was also an occasional poem in a sense.
Yeah.
It was also a sonnet.
And a
sonnet. Bernadette, you know, has written amazing sonnets. And then there was something about her Song of the Semite. I asked Bernadette if she had read that poem, but that Lazarus wrote a poem called Song of the Semite. And she also translated Goethe and was in touch with Emerson. I mean, that's a very rich legacy.
So was your sense, talking to Bernadette, that she really knows, you know, her Lazarus?
Yeah, I think as New York kids do who grow up in the city. And yes, I would say so.
Great. Thanks for checking in with her before you came here.
I better be, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Be
We're
careful
all
here.
In trouble otherwise.
Big trouble.
So anyway, we like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of what we call Gathering Paradise. And Anne, I forgot to tell you about this before, but you'll wing it. It's a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good, which is to say, to recommend something or someone, some new book, some new project going on in the poetry world. We call it Gathering Paradise. And so while Anne's thinking, because I didn't warn her about this, Julia, will you gather some paradise?
I've been really enjoying a book that's new to me. It's by Hilary Gravendike. It's called Harm. It's a book of poems from Omnidon Press. And Hilary's a fantastic poet who lives in eastern Los Angeles. It's a book about the body and nature and illness and silence and space. And it's just fantastic.
Say the name of the book again.
It's called Harm.
And the name of the poet.
Hilary Gravendike.
Great. Thank you. Katie Price.
I'd just like to say Vanessa Place's Statement of Facts has been out for a while, but it's the first part of a trilogy, and the trilogy is now just finally out. And the two books that accompany it really complicate the controversial text, so I think they're worth checking out. Vanessa Place's Trigodia.
Terrific. Anne Waldman.
Oh,
Gathers
so many,
in Paradise.
So many.
You can have two.
Well, I'm really deep into Dave Graeber's Debt. The First 5,000 Years. Have you looked at that?
No.
That's quite a sweep.
Good.
And, you know, deconstructing all our ideas of debt and, you know, taking it back to slavery and to war. And
so it's kind of cultural history?
Cultural history. He's also an anthropologist, so there are lots of examples from his own research and sort of tribal gift economies of, you know, how, I mean, we're seeing this going on in other parts of the world, especially the woman's body and how that's used as sort of money and taking on the sins of others. I mean, there has been some recent documentation of that. So I recommend that. And at one point he sort of deconstructs the Holy Grail, and the Holy Grail was just a blank check.
Really?
So I'll leave
of
you
course
with that.
It was. Oh my God. That's perfect. Well, thank you. Thank you. All of you. That's all the cops who laugh and sneer at meetings we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks so much to my guests, Katie Price, Julia Block, and Anne Waldman, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer, Chris Martin, and to our editor, as always, Steve McLaughlin. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for another Poem Talk.